Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you so much for being there today with us. It's really fantastic that we get to talk to you, and we are so thrilled about that. Most of our members are very confused about the midlife crisis situation they found themselves in, including myself. So we would like to learn a little bit more. And for today, I thought our main focus is on the sales drive and how it all starts and develops into the midlife crisis. And then we have your daughter and I, we have set some other main topics for the next two calls. And if somebody has a different question, of course, we want to address them if there's time enough. But maybe we can just focus on the start of everything. What do you think?
Sure. So midlife crisis is what everybody is really interested in and most curious about, because that's what the group is formed around.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's start with the whole midlife crisis. The idea of midlife crisis is not even accepted by the psychology community in total. Not everybody agrees what it is. There are many people in the psychology world who don't even believe it's a thing. The world is split about the midlife crisis. They don't agree on what it is or how it works. So what I'm being drawn from, snapshot of my story, I lived 27 years of marriage made in hell. And in the 28th year, I fell in love with my wife, and that changed everything. And that story, I was going through a midlife crisis through part of those years. What we want to start with is what makes the midlife crisis in the very, very beginning. What is it that makes the midlife crisis? The answer is childhood. Childhood, the first 10 years, makes the midlife crisis. The childhood is what designs it and what makes it start. So the way this works is the first 10 years, while your brain is forming, what happens of your mother and father and of all the things they could do, there's 53,000 hours of time in those 10 years, waking time, that you could be exposed to your mother and father's ways and methods. And so there's three things that happen, that could happen: abandonment, abuse, and neglect. Abandonment, physical and emotional, abuse, physical, emotional, neglect, physical, emotional. And you can get any combination of those. And so the more you have abandonment, abuse, and neglect, the more you're on a scale. So let's think of the scale as 10 being the best emotional place to grow up. And let's think of 0 as the worst emotional place to grow up. And when I say emotional place, I'm talking about the environment that your mother and father made for you to grow up in. So when you think about abandonment, abuse, and neglect, if you're a 10 on that scale, your mom and dad were very together people. They were very content, happy people, and they were emotionally and mentally stable. And because they were emotionally and mentally stable, you were raised in a very happy home. You have a lot of happy memories, and you can recall them easily because you came into the world with no abandonment, no abuse, and no neglect. And so that's called a purpose home, where you're raised with a purpose. And then down at the 0 end, you have the worst emotional place to grow up. There is abandonment, there's abuse, and there's neglect. Your mother and father were very troubled people, and they dished out the abandonment, the abuse, and neglect. And by doing so, they put in your mind messages that literally you carry for a lifetime. And so I don't like calling them programs because they seem too permanent. I like to call them messages because there's a message vibrating in your mind that your mother and father put there. And that is the source of the midlife crisis. So even though your mother and father may be gone from the earth, or you may not be connected to them at all, whatever they built in the 10 years and installed in you, they are. Those messages are here and operating today. And so that's the source of the midlife crisis. And so now we can get into, you know, thousands of versions of stories of how the midlife crisis actually forms and becomes a thing. But the way you want to think of it is these messages take over the personality. Now, some of the women who are listening to me can remember that their husband was good, 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 year after year after year, and they thought everything was going to be fine. They thought they were going to be married for a lifetime. And all of a sudden, literally within a week, something happened to him. It could be a job loss, the death of a parent, an illness, a financial failure. It could be any a big event. And what one event, sometimes two events, three events. And these traumatizing events have a thing that they do. And what they do is they snap the midlife crisis messages into the personality of the man you knew. They literally turn on and start to operate his personality for him. And so his personality is not there anymore. What's there is now the messages from childhood. What's there is the abandonment, the abuse, and neglect messages of his first 10 years. And so it's a shock to your system to see this happen. This is not the man I married. That's what every woman says when she sees it. Because why is he not the man you married? Because the man you married's personality has been pushed in the back while the messages of his childhood have come to the front. And if you were really perceptive, you would notice this coming year after year after year. You would notice it coming. A little sign. So what the man is doing himself is he is feeling the messages coming and pushing all the time, pushing for expression. And so what he's doing is he's resisting. He's fighting it. He's saying, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And remember what he's saying no to. He's saying no to the ways of his mother and father. That's what he's saying no to. And he's aware enough to say no to them, knowing that what they are. It's the message of his mother and father. And they're pushing harder and harder. So between 35 and 45 years old, that's the pinnacle of when those messages really burst onto the scene. And when the man is taken over, he's literally taken over. His personality is pushed back, and the messages of his mother and father come to the front. So if he didn't smoke, now he smokes. If he didn't drink, now he drinks. If he didn't carouse with women, now he carouses with women. So all the changes from those messages, they take him over. And he's not a free man. He's not free to do what he wants and say what he wants. So the way you want to think of this is that he's switching between man and monster. The monster is the childhood. The man is the man you marry. And he can switch, and you can look in his eyes, and there'll be some women here who actually experience this. You can look in his eyes, and you can see the eyes change, and the monster comes. And you look in his eyes, and you know that's not your husband. And that's your visual proof that the man has been taken over by the monster of childhood. This is a thing I call the unlearnable fact. The unlearnable fact is childhood decides marriage. Childhood decides marriage. If you meet somebody for the first time and you want to know your future, all of your future, just find out about how much abandonment, how much abuse, and how much neglect happened in that man's life. And if you, the more you hear, the more you know you're going to suffer. Why? Because those messages are going to come, and they're going to come for you. They're not just going to come for him. They're going to come for you. And all kinds of terrible, twisted, dark things are going to happen, because that personality, that monster within, is going to come for you. So I want to stop here because I want to see if anybody has any questions or wants to talk about their experience with the midlife crisis man, because the midlife crisis man is the result of the first 10 years. So Beate, do you want to see if we got any questions?
Yeah, thank you very much, Larry. First of all, I wanted to say that it's exactly what I have experienced with my husband. I thought I had the best husband in the world, and then he just turned into that monster. And also, I had the experience with the eyes. So,
okay.
Definitely. The eyes were like death, like a demon. Not sure if anybody's supernatural when those people, when demons take over and the eyes are totally black and dark and no shine. So that's what I had. So I would like to let my members ask the questions right here. So please, people, ask Larry. You have the opportunity here to ask yourself, talk about your experiences briefly and ask him the questions. Please go for it.
Okay, let's see. Our first hand is Melissa. Let me see if I can get Melissa. Melissa, are you there? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. My husband gave me the I never loved you about a year ago, and he's involved in an emotional affair, but still claims even a year later that it's just a friendship and nothing more. And he's been in periods of deep depression throughout the year and suicidal thoughts and things like that. But he's now trying, he's to the point where he seems more normal at home and is being kinder to me, but he gives me maybe 10% as far as a husband, and she's still number one, and maintaining that it's just a friendship and bringing her into our children's lives and bringing her family over, like her brother and her dad, stuff like that. And I'm not really sure what to do because I don't want this woman in our lives. And this woman has blocked me on Facebook and is just causing a lot of drama in her family. And her her partner also feels like this is inappropriate and it's destroyed their relationship. So I have kind of, in the spring, told him that I wanted him to cut it off. And for like a short period, he did and went into a deep depression. And then told me this summer that we wouldn't be married if he didn't have her as well. So I've kind of just backed off and kind of ignored that it's happening. But it's still happening, and it's getting worse. And now my children are involved, like I was saying. So I don't know what to do to make this, to protect my kids or to protect myself, and or what I should be doing that would be better.
So, Melissa, you haven't talked about his childhood. Tell us about his childhood. I want to illustrate this.
Well, his dad's, they're both his parents are pretty strict people. I would call them self-righteous. They're very conservative, very concerned with morals and just how you are. They've been very critical of me throughout our entire relationship. His dad is pretty self-centered, and when we had children, told us that we should not let our children dictate our lives, and that's something my husband has kind of taken to the extreme. He's very involved in sports, and those are most important, and has told me that if he can't play sports, then he would die. His mom almost died of cancer when he was 9, and then he had some abuse happen to him when he was 11, 12 by another male outside of his parents, and his parents never knew about it. And as far as I know, I'm the only one who knows about it. But he has never dealt with that either. I'm not really sure about other neglects that have happened in his childhood. He's always told me he had a happy childhood. And when I met him, he held his parents in very high regard. But just my experience with his parents, they are very hard people, very strict, and very judgmental.
Okay, so strict, judgmental, oppressive, and self-righteous. So what you have is you have a suppressive home. That's called a suppressive home.
Okay.
And that's the home where you're not free to think what you want. You're not free to express yourself to your parents and actually have them listen. See, when parents are self-righteous, they believe that their answer is the only answer. And if you're a child, you really don't have a right to an opinion. Your opinion is only the parents' opinion. And so that's the way you're raised. And you're raised typically to think that mom and dad know the right thing, they do the right thing, they're the best answer to everything. And so he would say he has a happy childhood. He would say that mom and dad know the answer because he doesn't see what you just explained. You
okay.
have the freedom to see them as they are, but your husband doesn't have the freedom to see them as they are. He's not free to see them as they are. And so in his heart, deep inside his heart, he senses that he can't really be himself. So what he did is he found himself another woman to make himself another family, to release himself from the oppression of his parents. So that's what this girlfriend is. This girlfriend is a way for him to rebel against his parents. You see that energy? He's
yeah.
literally rebelling against his suppressive parents, who always had the last word, who always said what the way it's going to be. He didn't have any freedom. So in your marriage, with him, did you ever become the strongest opinion?
Yes.
Did you become,
at times.
Yes, you became the strongest opinion. Okay. So now that means he doesn't have the strongest opinion. You do. And what that does is that creates a repeat memory of his suppressive childhood. And now he has to live in a suppressive white world. Who's got the last opinion? Who's got the final say? And he doesn't have any strength at all. And so because he has no strength, because he can't push away the parents, because he can't push away the wife, because the parents are dominating, the wife is dominating, what can I do? He finds himself another woman who's not dominating. That's what he finds. A woman who's not dominating. A woman who wants to listen to him. A woman who thinks he's wonderful, who tells him wonderful things. And she creates a fantasy world that his parents and his wife didn't create. And that's what he says, I have to have her because I won't be able to stay married. I won't be able to stay married because if I don't have her, this woman who literally releases me from my oppressive wife and releases me from my oppressive parents, if I don't have her, I'll kill myself. And so that's why he's suicidal. Because the morality of this is very, very troubling. Because the parents installed a system of morality that's oppressive. You've got to do it this way. It's religious, right? It's demanding. It's not flexible. It doesn't have any grace in it. It's just an oppressive system. And so he's looking to escape that oppressive system, and this woman is how he's doing it. Now, do you sense that's true?
Yeah. Everything you said resonates with how it's kind of played out. It very much seems like that's what he's wanting is a release, because he said things like she's laid back before. And so then after the suicidal stuff happened, I just kind of let go. And especially with the kids, I kind of just let him have more say in things. But I'm finding that it's really hurting the kids. They've become overly clingy towards him. And I'm really starting to worry about their well-being emotionally, because they see a psychologist for learning disabilities, and we've talked about what's going on, and she has told me that might be a sign that they sense that he's in leaving mode, but they still don't understand, like, consciously what's going on. But it's been getting increasingly worse, even though he's been around them a little bit more lately.
Okay, so you are deeply involved in the day-to-day, blow-by-blow, event by event, goings and comings of your husband and your children. And you have a moral code yourself. Now, what was your childhood like? Did you have any abandonment, abuse, or neglect?
Yes.
What happened to you?
It's just me and my brother, and my parents always favored him over me. I was a very hyperactive child that had some learning disabilities, and my mom always kind of used that make me feel like I wasn't really a good child. So I had to fight against that a lot. And my mom was very strict, not in the moral sense, but just in, she had a high anxiety level that I realize now, but didn't know then, but she yelled a lot. When I was in seventh grade, my dad left for 2 months, and I felt a great deal of burden that it was my fault at that time. But when he came back, he told me that it was my fault, and I had to deal with that for years. But any time that he thought,
okay.
My mom would leave.
All right.
Yeah, she would leave the room and lock herself in her bedroom. So I dealt with a lot of, like, running away behaviors. And that's something I knew in myself is that, and I always told my husband this, you know, that I was a runner and always thanked him for being there for our family and holding us together. Like, this is something we've talked about a lot and throughout our marriage, because my mom is a runner, and that's what I grew up learning.
All right, so now what you can say, let's go back to that scale. 10 is the best emotional place to grow up, and 0 is the worst. Where do you think you were raised?
I would probably say between 7 and 8. I don't know. I mean, I didn't suffer any, like, physical abuse, just a lot of emotional.
Okay, so you're a 7. If you're a 7, where's your husband on that scale?
I've had a hard time placing him because I see stuff from his childhood now, but didn't before, and he always seemed to have it together. So I'm not really sure, but I do know, you know, like, he almost lost his mom, he had abuse later on, so I don't know, maybe around the same.
So you want to think of that oppressive parent system he grows up in. Oppressiveness, religious oppressiveness, for instance, that's one form of oppressiveness. You oppress a child when you make them follow demanding rules that are cruel and have no grace in them, no forgiveness in them. They're just very demanding. That's a form of neglect, and it's also a form of abandonment. Because while you're dishing out this oppressive life, you're literally not connecting with the child as a person. You're literally saying, this is good for you. This is the way you have to have it. Too bad for you if you don't like it. Right? That's a form of abandonment. And
okay.
So what the story that you're telling about what he's doing in finding this woman to replace his parents and to replace his suppressive wife is that's where he is. And I'm going to talk about in a little bit about what you can do. What you can do.
Okay.
I want to hold on to the story, because thank you for telling the story, Melissa, because now we have a portrait of your story, and we have a set of particulars in your story that we can start to understand, oh, okay, so that's why he's being this way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in your story, you have a suppressive childhood. Your mother was giving you suppression. She was saying, you're not enough. You're not the right person. I don't approve of you, right? That's a form of abandonment.
Okay.
That's a form of abuse, right? So you're coming into the marriage with messages of abuse and messages of abandonment, right? And those messages are permanent. They are lifelong messages until you finally deal with them. He has those messages. You have those messages. And now they are forming behaviors. And what you're doing is you're saying, I got to protect my children from this. I got to protect my children from this. And you got to remember, we ourselves are not close enough to ourselves to really understand how our messages are affecting us. All we're seeing is what's happening to him. What is he doing? What's his problem? What's wrong with him? That's what we're really good at. We're good at seeing what's wrong with the guy out there. We're not good at seeing what's wrong with ourselves. Because we don't like thinking about that. It's painful. We got enough of that in childhood. We don't want it now. So I'm going to put you on hold. And we've got some other hands. I want to get some other stories here so we can get the mix and the portrait of what happens in the midlife crisis between the woman who's not in the midlife crisis and the man that is. All right, hold on. Kate, I can hear you. Are you there?
I don't know if you can hear me.
I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I didn't realize I could talk through the computer.
Oh, good.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Okay. When you said a scale of 0 to 10, was 0 like the bad childhood, or 10 the bad childhood? I can't remember now.
0 is the worst emotional place to grow up, and 10
again,
is the best
is
emotional
the
place
best
to grow
emotional.
Up.
Okay. My husband grew up in really, I mean, he blocked out at least 80% or more of his childhood. He can't remember. I mean, he has a bad memory. He's always had a bad memory, but then he really doesn't remember his childhood.
By the way, I want to stop you there. When a man or a woman says, I don't remember my childhood, what they're saying is, my mental system has blocked out the pain I would have experienced by taking all the memories away.
Right.
So I don't have to consciously live with them.
Right.
And what that is it was bad. When you don't remember your childhood, it was bad. Not sometimes, all the time.
Right.
So when you hear the, I don't remember my childhood, big warning flag there. It was bad.
Because he's one of nine. It's like a big family. So I hear stories from his other siblings as far as what went on. And he does remember some of the stuff, but a lot of the details were filled in by the other siblings. As far as what happened in his childhood, his mother had an eating disorder for like decades, I mean, she was crazy. She was a bulimic. And she's also very devout Catholic. She's extremely controlling of her children. Her husband was a traveling salesman, so he wasn't home a whole lot. But even when he was home, he was the quiet guy, and he just let her run everything and didn't really speak up about anything that she was doing. She made all the children go to church every single day before school. And the church was across the street from their school, so they walked to church. But then they weren't allowed to walk to school right after church. They had to walk all the way back and then all the way to school again because she didn't want them to have that free time. And in the evening, in the afternoon anyway, when they came back from school, they were given their dinner like really early, something like 4:30 in the afternoon or something, and they were made to go to bed by like 5:30. I mean, this is kind of crazy behavior, you know? And on top of that, she was abusive. I mean, a lot of the things she does, if that was happening now, her children would have been taken away by diapers, you know? Children's would have taken them away.
We were talking to Melissa, and what I was talking about is suppression. And in Melissa's story, there was different kinds of suppression. Now we go to your story, and now we hear, again, another system of suppression.
Right.
And this is suppression, control, discouragement, demand, cruelty.
Right.
And then what you're doing is you're portraying children who were traumatized by the mother.
Right.
Those are messages of suppression and fear and worry and doubt and anxiety.
Right.
That's what they produce.
Right.
And so when those messages turn on, your husband is going to be very, very fearful and very, very wanting to protect himself all the time from being controlled. Now, are you a pretty strong-willed woman?
Yes.
Okay. So he married a strong-willed woman to duplicate the environment of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know this?
I don't know.
This is true?
I mean, when he had his little breakdown, he accused me of dominating him, which I tried to get him to explain that, but I just didn't see it because it's not like I've ever stopped him from doing anything that he's wanted to do. You know, he likes to go
for watching everything. We're not talking about stopping him from doing what he wants to do.
Right.
We're not talking about that kind of suppression.
Okay.
We're talking about this in your case. We're talking about you're not a woman who forces him to do what his mother did. That's not what you do.
Right.
What you do is you create a suppression by suggestion. And you think, suggestion? How can I suppress him with suggestion? And you know what I mean by suggestion? You infer that what he's doing is not a good idea.
Right.
You imply that what he said was not the best thought.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do it by having an opinion. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And you express the opinion.
Right.
And you think, hey, it's perfectly normal to express an opinion. Not if you're married to this guy.
Right.
Not if you're married to this guy with the mother who marched you to church and marched you back to home and then marched you to school. And you had to live in a concentration camp of control.
Right.
So now even a suggestion can actually turn on the messages of his childhood.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm going to be talking about...
The other thing he said, which was just... I mean, it blew my mind when I heard it, which is that he said our relationship reminds him of the relationship that his parents had, even though... He says he feels like his father did. Even though we are nothing like them. Those were his words, you know?
So what he's saying is, don't look at the obvious behavior differences. Don't look at behavior differences. I want you to look at my feelings. I want you to look at how I feel. And if you look at how I feel, this marriage of ours is a lot like my parents.
Right.
Now, what was it? A very weak man married to a very dominating woman. Dominating in every way. a man who had no power, no control, no opinion, no rights, no privileges, no ability to be free and choose. He was a slave to the state.
Right.
And that's what happens when really strong personalities marry really weak personalities. That's what happens. And so what he's expressing to you is, hey, I'm my father in this marriage. I have no rights, no privileges, no ability to have an opinion. I don't even know who I am anymore because you're so suppressive. And when he talks like that, you say, hey, I never stop you from doing or anything. And that's what you're doing. You're making an interpretation that's sending you in the wrong direction.
Right.
The interpretation he's trying to tell you is, my father was a weak man. My mother was a super dominating woman.
Right.
I feel like I'm my weak father. I feel like you're my dominating mother.
But here's the
That's
weird,
really what he's trying to say.
Yeah, but here's the weird thing. I mean, he's involved with this woman who was supposedly our mutual friend or whatever. But she's very she has control issues, and she is actually a fairly dominating character. So she seems to have run from me to somebody who's more like has more of a control issue. And
don't let that confuse you, because what you are is you're a brand of control, a particular
right.
version of control. When he goes to another woman, he goes to a different brand of control that he's more comfortable with. But here's the thing, he never can be a free man, and in his heart he knows it. He can't be free to choose. He can't be free to think. He can't be free to have an unquestioned opinion, and he's trapped. He can't
get
out.
Right.
So I'm going to be talking about that when I get to what is the solution when you're living in it. So, Kate, I want to hold on to you and thank you for your story, because that helps us build this case that I'm working here to make. So Kate's story, we have suppression, and Melissa's story, we have suppression. Now I'm going to check in with Judy. Let's see if I can get Judy. Kimberly, are you there? Kimberly,
yes,
can you hear me?
Uh-huh, I can hear you. Can you
okay,
hear
good, I got you. All right, great.
Yeah, so my husband, he was 10, and his father passed away very unexpectedly. Like, he just went to sleep on the couch after dinner and didn't wake up.
That
he didn't have any known health issues necessarily. So his mom was a stay-at-home mom, and so she had to go back to work. She had 4 boys at home that she was taking care of, and that was really difficult for all of them. And so he really, I think, took on this mentality of, like, I think all of the boys did, that they had to, like, step up and take care of their mom. And she still struggles with her grief. It was on Monday was 20 years since he passed away. And she still wears her wedding ring and has never dated or done anything like that. So all of the boys still really try to take care of her. And so I don't think he's ever really dealt with his grief. Like, we've been together for 16 years and married for 10. And the closest he's ever come to talking to me about his father's death is just that it happened a long time ago. And there's no sense in talking about it because he's gone and he's not going to come back. So, like, I don't think he's ever really addressed his grief. So he was like 10 when his dad passed away. He's always really just kind of, I think, stuffed his emotions down and tried to step up and be there for his mom and that sort of thing. And then when he was in 8th grade, he had a TBI from playing football and missed an entire year of school. And when he came back from that, all of the friends that he had previously no longer wanted to be his friend. And so he really only had one friend, which happened to be my cousin. And so after that, he really hated a lot of people at school. We are from a really small town. He started smoking pot, doing a lot of other things. But he really lost a lot of his memories from his dad after that TBI. Like, he had to learn how to rewrite his name and some stuff like that. And so when you ask him about his dad, like, do you remember doing this with your dad or doing that, or his brothers share memories of his dad, like, he doesn't remember a lot of those things. So flash forward to about, I guess, 4 years ago, we had our second child, and I ended up having really severe postpartum depression, but he doesn't really believe in mental health issues, even though I'm a social worker and I work in mental health. And so I was really kind of afraid to tell him that that's what I was struggling with when I was irritable and really struggled at home. So I just kind of went to work and was breastfeeding our child, and I that's really all I could do. I cooked dinner and I went to work and I breastfed our child and that was it. And he took care of our other child and did everything at home. And I think that he never really talked to me about it and I didn't talk to him about it. And I think that he felt like, here I am again and I can't talk to you about this and I have to do everything and I have to suck it up and stuff everything down and be the strong person again. And why am I the one that always has to be the strong person and I don't want to do this again? So he's told me many times. He just left in July, but he told me last fall that he wanted to leave and said he needed me to do like A, B, and C to stay. So I did those things and he's pretended to be happy for the last year, but then he just out of nowhere in July decided he was leaving again. So he's been gone since then. And he swears, you know, he's not coming back. But he just keeps telling me, you know, he's doing this for his own happiness. And when does he get to worry about his own happiness? And, you know, he just is tired of bottling things up. And time for him to worry about himself.
Kimberly, look at the story. This is not the conventional story of painful childhood. There's some twists here. And the twists are the father dies suddenly. A loved father dies suddenly, and the mother grieves bitterly for a long, long time. And you stole my happiness from me. I hate God, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the boys have to become the father. They have to become the leader. They have to take responsibility. They have to grow up quickly, suddenly. And this is, for some personalities, this kind of environment is very, very hard to take on suddenly. And your husband had to take it on suddenly, and he didn't do well with it.
Mm-hmm.
So now that he has to carry the burden of, I have to do all the work, I have to do all the, right, the heaviness, I have to take the heaviness on. Because you don't really know what it was like to be there with that widow after the death of Dad. You don't know what it was really like for him. But he's not a talker, your husband. He's not a guy who can put his feelings into words. But Kimberly, you are a talker.
Yes.
And you're good at talking. Talking is your strength. And you want your husband to be a talker also, right?
Well, it would be nice.
Yes, you want him to be a talker. And you never give up the expectation that he will talk as well as you do, that he will express his feelings as well as you do in words. But he is not a talker. And he can't express his feelings in words. His whole story is about bottling up emotion
mm-hmm.
to the point where he denies that there's a mind. You can't have mental health issues. There is no mental. You're just a body. That's what you are. So he's in denial of that.
Yeah, and there is another person. I mean, he's been friends with this other woman at work for several years, and he, I think, has shared, he told her that he was unhappy with me long before he ever told me, and he's opened up to her and told her things that he's never told me. You know, that kind of thing. And he tells me that emotionally, you know, she's, you know, on par with him more so than anyone else has ever been. And she was there for him when I wasn't, you know, that kind of thing.
So that's what men pursue women for, or when they get women to pursue them. What they're getting, they want. They want what they're getting. And when you look at what they're getting some woman to come and undo what happened in their childhood. In effect,
mm-hmm.
like taking away suppression, if you were suppressed, taking away criticism, if you were criticized, taking away denial, if you were denied. You know, whatever that woman does, she literally does it like some kind of a hospital giving a treatment, and that's really what he sees. She's my hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care that I'm being immoral. I don't care that I'm finding another woman to replace the wife I have. I don't care about that at all. Why? Because I'm desperate to survive. You feel this?
Yeah.
You look at your husband, you go, he's desperate to survive. He's not choosing this woman because he has a great relationship with her. That's not it. This woman is giving him relief. And it's relief that you don't know how to give. Because you don't understand him. You understand him in your way, but you don't understand that he has a need for great relief to relieve him of the childhood pain he's carrying. And the woman does that. She doesn't even know how she does it. So you don't have a conventional chaos childhood here. You have chaos that came as a result of a death, which he has to carry. And he's not a talker, so he can't talk through this stuff because he can't put his feelings into words. But you can. And you've probably had times when you've tried to get him to do what you do, put your feelings into words. True?
Yeah. No, I tried to get him to talk about it, and he just won't.
He always feels like a failure compared to you because you're so good at putting feelings into words, and he's not. So he doesn't even want to try. So, Kimberly, have you thought of that? That you're a good talker and he's not? You're a good expressor of emotions into words and he is not?
Not really. I mean,
have you ever thought of that?
I mean, I know that that's there. I mean, that that's a thing, but I guess I didn't really think of the impact that that had.
It has a huge impact. And a couple after couple after couple, it's almost like we marry each other. The talkers marry the non-talkers. Not because they want to, not because they understand, they just attract to each other. So you are a talker, and you have in you a vibe of I want to talk, I want to express, I want to get my feelings out, and I'm good at it. You should be good at it, too. And if you have this feeling, that feeling's going to go on to him, and he's going to feel judged because he's not a good talker. He can't put his feelings into words. He doesn't even know how to put the words together.
Sure.
Yet you are very good at it, and he knows how good you are at it. And he feels inadequate every time.
What do you do about that?
Well, I'm gonna get to that when we get. So we've got three sets of stories, and what I'm dramatizing here is I'm dramatizing that the midlife crisis is not a strange, weird surprise. It's not. It's childhood pain expressing itself, taking over the personality, and you have to deal with it. And when that personality comes out, there's typically a girlfriend involved. And the girlfriend has all the wonderful qualities, and you don't. And you feel bad, and you feel angry, and you feel hurt, and you feel rejected. You feel all these things. And that's leading me to the thing I want to talk about, which is called against energy. Against energy is a very, very destructive force. Against energy is this world. This world is full of against energy. Against energy is when you're angry, hurt, pissed off, frustrated, worried, mad at yourself, mad at somebody else, resistance of all kinds as against energy. And so keep this idea of against energy, because against energy hurts you. You know, when the world talks about stress and how bad stress is, they're talking about against energy. Against energy is the source of all stress, the source of all sickness, the source of all sorrow, the source of all bitterness, the source of all loss, the source of all destruction of families. It's the source of everything, against energy. So what I want to do now, with the time we have remaining, I want to talk about an analogy. I want to give you an analogy, because where you are is you're deeply in the ocean of against energy. So I want to give you an analogy. It's called the ocean and the beach. The ocean and the beach goes like this. We are born into an ocean of against energy, an ocean. It doesn't matter which ocean, Atlantic, Pacific, Mediterranean Sea, doesn't matter what ocean, wherever you go in the ocean, there are sharks. And sharks are always a threat. And so you can't get away from sharks no matter which ocean you go into, because the ocean is full of sharks. And sharks are against energy. So the only way out is to get on the beach. And when you get to the beach, you have freedom from sharks. Because sharks can't follow you to the beach. They can follow you anywhere in the ocean, and they're strong, but when you get to the beach, that's their weakness. They can't go on the beach. And so the threat is sharks. So the job you have is to get out of the ocean, and you get out of the ocean in four steps. Now, it's really important that you write this down, because you're not going to remember this. This is not a thing that you can easily remember, these four steps. So I'm going to go through the four steps, because the job is to get out of the ocean of against energy and onto the beach where there is no against energy. And once you're in an environment of no against energy, you have a chance to start to think freely for yourself and not suffer the pain being dished out by the man you're married to. And that's the most important thing I want to say first, is you need relief yourself. You don't need to fix him. You need relief yourself. Because you are now in the ocean of against energy, and you can't get out. So the four steps start with the first step. The first step of getting out of the ocean is called acceptance. And the acceptance statement is, I accept I'm in the ocean of against energy. That's simple. I accept I'm in the ocean of against energy. When you say that statement, what you're doing is you're making the first separation between the ocean and yourself. Because the ocean of against energy doesn't want you to accept anything. It wants you to be against everything. And so you're now making an acceptance statement about being in the ocean. The second step out of the ocean is called gratitude. And the second step says, I have gratitude that I'm in the ocean of against energy because. And this because is very important. Because I learn from pain, and this is the pain that teaches me. That's why I have gratitude. I have gratitude because I'm in the ocean, I'm learning from pain, and I'm learning, and that's changing everything. The second step is gratitude. The third step is appreciation. The third step of appreciation, it comes with the appreciation question. The appreciation question, which the against energy ocean doesn't ever allow, is what do I love about you? What do I love about you? So for your husband, so Kimberly, if you think about your husband, and I ask you to name three things right now that you love most about your husband, what are the three things you would name?
I love that he's a super great dad, and he's always been a great dad. I love how much he cares about his mom and his family. And I love how much, how hard that he's worked in order for me, like, working for me so I could go through college, and how hard he's worked in his current job, and how, like, now he's a supervisor and he's been promoted several times.
All right. So you have three things you love about him. And when you say the three things you love about him, you know what I love about you. And you say it to yourself. The names for three specific things you love about him. You are now creating the third separation from the ocean. And the separation brings relief to you. But it's the fourth step out of the ocean that gets you on the beach. The fourth step is called quantum forgiveness, like quantum physics. Quantum physics teaches us that at the subatomic level, electrons, protons, and neutrons, we are all joined together. We are all one in the subatomic world. This world is generated out of the subatomic world. And at that base foundation, we are all one. We are all together. And so what you want to do is you want to have quantum forgiveness, not religious forgiveness. Because religious forgiveness says, you are separate from me, I'm separate from you. You hurt me, and I was hurt, but I'm better than you because I'm going to forgive you anyway. And I may not forget, but I'm going to forgive you. That's religious forgiveness. We want quantum forgiveness, which says, when I forgive you, I'm also forgiving myself at the same time. So these are the words of quantum forgiveness you want to write down. The first statement is, you are good. Or you can say, we are good, to bring that oneness idea together. We are good. The second statement is, pure and innocent. Pure and innocent. The third statement is, all is forgiven and released. All is forgiven and released. This is quantum forgiveness. You are good, we are good, pure and innocent, all is forgiven and released. And when you do this, you are forgiving your husband of anything he happened to do that hurt you, offended you, irritated you, frustrated you, made you angry, or put you in against energy. You're forgiving him, and you're not only forgiving him, you're forgiving other people with the same method. We are good, pure and innocent, all is forgiven and released. And what you're doing is you're getting out of the ocean completely and staying out of the ocean with quantum forgiveness. So the four steps, I accept I'm in the ocean of against energy. Second step, I have gratitude that I'm in the ocean of against energy because I learned from pain, and this is the pain that teaches me. The third step, what do I love about you? The appreciation question. And then, finally, quantum forgiveness. Those are the four steps out of the ocean. And those four steps are the beginning of learning that against energy really is your problem. It's really why you're suffering. You're suffering because you're in the ocean of against energy. It's not a place where a human being belongs. And yet, who raised us? We were raised by people who were in the ocean of against energy. They were against things. They were proud of being against things. They like to be against. Damn it, I'm mad as hell and I'm not taking it anymore. Right? They are proud of it. They're glad to be against things. They're defending their stance about being against. They're in the ocean and happy that they're in the ocean. They're mad at stuff. Right? So that's the world we're coming from. And yet that's the world that makes us suffer. The ocean makes us suffer. Got to get on the beach, because on the beach is where the relief is. The ocean is where we suffer. And so when you look at your reactions to your husband, and all of you have got a husband that made you suffer. And so what you did is the ocean told you how to deal with it. The ocean against energy told you, be mad, be angry, be hurt, be frustrated, be pity yourself, feel bad for yourself, escape into alcohol, escape into drugs, escape, punish yourself. That's what the ocean did. And the only chance you have is to get out of the ocean. And what this man is doing in his sad state is he is giving you an opportunity to get out of the ocean for the first time in your life. Because if he hadn't melted down into the midlife crisis, you would never be willing to learn what I'm teaching. So I have a course called Survive a Midlife Crisis. And if you go to surviveamidlifecrisis.com/Larry, you will see some resources on that page that can help you. So surviveamidlifecrisis.com/Larry. And so if you decide you want to purchase any of those things, there's a 20% discount if you use the letters MLC, Midlife Crisis, MLC. That's the promo code. And you'll get a discount on those things. So one of them is a book and audio CDs called Soft Hearted Woman. And Soft Hearted Woman is a book and two CDs that help you with these ideas that I'm talking about. There's a lot of ideas in this book, and they're all really geared around getting out of this against energy world that is so destructive to happiness. All right, so how are we doing on time? Okay. Yate, are you still there?
Yes, I am still there, and I think it's the time run out for today, and I want to thank you so much, Larry, for being there for us, and I want to just share a personal feeling I had with each of the women you talked to. I found a little bit of similarity with my own husband and what happened, and what you taught us today opens my eyes a lot. And especially the last thing about the against energy resonated with me extremely. And I hope the same happened to everybody who was here today. I apologize to those who were not able to be heard today. Nevertheless, I'm sure just by listening, they learned a good amount. And I would assume that similarities have been recognized through the other cases, which somebody can draw conclusions for their own cases. We'll discuss with your daughter the link and the pin for the discount, so we'll put that on our page too, and as well as the recording for all those who were not able to join us. I look forward
to it. Okay, and Beate, I will get this recording to you.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. So they can listen to it again.
Exactly. And I really look forward to next month and to learn more.
Okay. All right, Beate. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, and thank you for being there.
All right. We'll talk next time. Okay. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.